From the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, this is The Steady Stater, a podcast dedicated to discussing limits to growth in the steady state economy.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brian Check, and our guest today is Chris Matthews. Yes, that Chris Matthews of Hardball fame. Hardball with Chris Matthews ran for 23 seasons, 1997 to 2020, primarily under the MSNBC banner. Chris also hosted the syndicated Chris Matthews Show for about 10 of those years. He's also a prolific author with a dozen titles on politics and history. A Beltway insider before he ever appeared on TV, he served as a Capitol Police officer, a congressional staffer, a speechwriter for President Carter, and chief of staff for the late Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House during the Reagan years. Chris holds 34 honorary degrees from various colleges and universities. Chris Matthews, welcome to the Steady Stater.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be on.
Well, it's great to have you. And, you know, I want to start by asking you, what was your favorite and or your most memorable episode of Hardball?
Oh, my God. I don't know. I think it might have been Donald Trump in the campaign. The one he won in 16. And it was about, I asked him if there should be punishment for a woman who chooses to have an abortion. And he sort of wiggled around for a while. He wasn't really ready for that. And he said, yes, there needs to be some kind of punishment. Well, of course, that was his understanding of what the pro-life movement's about. His understanding. And then, an hour or two later, we get the call, the words out. He didn't mean that. He pulled that back. But I think it showed that he was a political newcomer and he knew some of the language, but he didn't know the full meaning of the politics or the value system involved. And he got caught showing he didn't know what he's talking about in that case. It certainly wasn't, he wasn't consistent with the pro-life leaders.
Right.
There's another time a young guy from California, a talk show host, who kept using the word appeasement. with a capital A, of course. And I said, well, what was, I just, you always do with a hunch. My hunch was he didn't know what he's talking about. And I said, well, what was appeasement?
Oh, boy.
He had no idea about it. He never heard Sudetenland. He didn't know anything about Czechoslovakia or what happened. He didn't know and what happened in 38 in Munich and all that stuff. And he was just, and he sort of admitted it. And I have to tell you, it's awful to say, but it is fun when people just don't know what they're talking about and you catch them. I have to tell you, that may be a wicked joy, but it's there.
Right. I hope it doesn't happen today.
Well, okay. Try me.
Yeah. Well, I understand you have another book in the hopper, but just as a teaser, keep our steady staters' whistles wetted. What's the title of this new book?
Well, let me just tell you, the book that's out there now that just came out this past June is This Country, My Life in Politics and History. And it's a memoir, but it also talks about all the covers, the big stories I was able to cover in person, the Berlin Wall coming down, the first ever all races election in South Africa, the Good Friday talks up in Northern Ireland. So it really talks about you are there kind of thing. Try to share with readers what it's like to actually be on the front lines covering these stories. But it also has a lot of politics in it. All the elections going back to, my God, back to, I guess, the Eisenhower election in 52, which I remember as a kid. And wow. So it's really kind of a history book from a first-person perspective. I do have another one, but it's still in negotiations with Simon & Schuster as of last night around midnight. So I can't.
Oh.
I can't reveal it yet unless I get an email during this conversation today.
Okay. Well, that gives us a good reason to get you back on later.
Yeah. Well, I had some ideas that, I wanted to do a Churchill book because he's my hero. And but it's very hard to sell that today with some people because they think it's, who knows what their views are. But my view is he's a great man. So.
Absolutely. Well, you could regale us with political stories left and right, so to speak.
I could do that, and I will at your calling.
Okay. Well, Right now, we want your insights, particularly with steady state politics, and perhaps we could start with President Carter. It's our understanding that Carter read Limits to Growth, and then he commissioned a follow-up of sorts called Global 2000, and even invited the great steady stater, E.F. Schumacher, to the White House. Clearly, Carter got it about the conflict between economic growth and environmental protection. So, Chris, did he ever express an interest in developing public awareness about limits to growth and possibly even the steady state economy as the alternative?
You know, he did read the Club of Rome report. Apparently, he certainly talked like he did. And I read it at the time. And I have to tell you that it showed in, of course, the gas lines as a symptom. We were waiting in line. I mean, I remember waiting on the New Jersey Turnpike, and you had to go on odd days, depending on your license number, what the last digit was, the last letter. You had to have your tank almost empty before you could actually get gas at the next gas station. And then you had to wait in line. So people got the message there was something going on about resources. But of course, the Club of Rome and the whole idea of resources goes beyond energy and fossil fuel. It was the idea that we're a limited number of resources on this planet, a growing number of people, and there's going to have to be a reckoning at some point. And I think Carter, to his credit or discredit, was a very tight guy about money, for example. He was very aware of costs and limits. And I've just been reading his diary, and I tell you, he talks all about, we can't afford this, we can't afford that. His big fight with Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, in their primary fight in 80 was, or rather, you know, in 80, was about the fact that we can't do everything we want to do right now in healthcare. So he had a sort of a farmer's and small business notion of costs and income, and he knew that they had to match. And he was just by nature a man who understood limits. And sometimes that came across in money, and it came across in the heating, turning the thermostat down, putting on your sweater, recognizing costs in a big sense. So I think it wasn't hard for him to buy into the idea that the planet has its limits.
Yeah. Well, I don't suppose you wrote the so-called Millais speech, did you?
No, I did not. I would not. I didn't touch that. I will take credit for the kickoff speech in down south when he started the campaign on Labor Day of 1980. I did write one on youth employment and education. Oh. I wrote a lot of the political speech. I was on the plane the last couple of weeks, and I knew I did the politics, but that, as you called the so-called Millais speech, went over well. Mm-hmm. And then he took the resignation of the entire cabinet in a couple of days, and that's what hurt him politically. It looked like chaos, you know, and that was not intended.
Yeah, and well, I hate it when they call it the Millais speech too, because I thought it was exactly the leadership we needed then, and even more so, the leadership we desperately need now. Here's a quote from that speech. Carter said, "Every act of energy conservation is more than just common sense. I tell you, it is an act of patriotism." And he also said, "We've learned that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no confidence or purpose." End quotes, and I say yes.
Yeah, I know, and well, that's Jimmy Carter. You know, that's not exactly a rah-rah session in the cheerleading department. It doesn't make people go giddy, like, whereas Ronald Reagan always spoke in terms of exhilaration of the audience, and effectively so. He made people feel good. He went to the Statue of Liberty to begin his campaign that very day, Labor Day, 1980. And there he is with his short sleeves or his rolled-up sleeves, acting like Mr. American Cowboy, and everything's great. And he was really good at that. Morale officer, you might call him.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Carter was coldly realistic. He was stoic in his own life. I don't think he had a problem explaining the turn down the thermostat instead of just buying a gas guzzler. And, the fact that Ronald Reagan, I understood the romance of Reagan. I'm certainly not a Republican hater. I'm not. But I thought that the first thing he did practically when he moved into the White House was take the solar panels off the roof by executive order. I mean, excuse me, who are they hurting? you know?
And then he appointed James Watt as Secretary of the Interior.
Well, he wanted to just big car, lots of gas in the tank, low mileage, show off. I mean, yeah. it was that sort of, I don't know.
It was Trump before there was Trump. And, you know, anything to spend more and stimulate the economy.
Flaunting resource reduction. And dig more wells, pump more gas, and that's the solution. Well, obviously it's not the solution, but I don't know how. Well, you know, look at these, look at population growth. And one of the things you study in economic development is that because of colonization in the third world, developing world, you do reach countries with health care. They have health care they never had before. So there's no Malthusian reduction of population. The people in the countries like I served in the Peace Corps, they do get some health care out. The missionaries bring health care and some education, and besides religion, they teach people how to survive. But the population growth is still huge. I mean, you have 8 kids, and look at the numbers coming out of Africa and the resource depletion. One of the things I noticed, and this is pretty rudimentary, but I learned it myself. If you rely on a subsistence farm and you grow corn, maize, and you have to live on that all year round. So you have a crop comes in the fall and you reap it and you hide it somewhere and you keep it, somehow preserve it. And you try to live all year on that. Well, you have to have heat to cook the maize. You can't just eat raw corn. So you have to have, usually, unfortunately for the wife in the family goes looking for wood. And she'll go for miles, and more each day, further and further away, looking for trees that have fallen down, branches that are available, or pull the tree up. And so in Africa, you can see the loss of trees, of wood, for firewood. It's gone. So there's a case of where population grows because of healthcare, and the supply of a basic need, wood, disappears. So what happens? To me, it's just tragedy. Yeah. I don't know how people make it, and this is just a exponential reality. More people looking for wood going further away. There are no trees that can possibly grow fast enough with the trees that the Chinese don't buy. I should say, it's awesome. It's an awesome challenge. And these people, just think of the image you have of Africa. It's usually of an African woman with a bundle of trees on her head, carrying it home to cook the meal. Mm-hmm. It's something. So just depletion of resources right in front of your face.
Yeah. You know, it's been great so far, Chris. And next we want to talk some more about some policy issues. But first we need to take a short non-commercial break with James Lamont. Take it away, James.
Hello, listeners. We hope you're enjoying the show. Like many of our guests on The Steady Stater, Chris Matthews is a signatory to the Cassie Position Statement on Economic Growth. He's one of many notable signatories among our ranks, including esteemed scientists, economists, and other thinkers. You can see a list of these notables by going to our website, steadystate.org, and clicking the Position button. Then click the Signatures and Endorsements link in the right-hand menu. You may see a name that proves useful in convincing friends and family members to sign the position themselves. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back, Steady Staters. We're talking with Chris Matthews of Hardball Lore. Well, you know, Schumacher called for the maximum of well-being with the minimum of consumption. Can you envision any of today's politicians, American politicians, calling for the maximum of well-being with the minimum of consumption?
I do think it this way, and maybe this is strange, but when I think about the population, human, an animal that we discovered when the Europeans came to America, would have probably gone on forever, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could have. They were relatively steady states among,
you know,
the
they get bear skins to get through the winter with, to use for clothing. They don't have any industry. They don't burn up too much. They just have occasional fire to survive with. They don't glut themselves. And that everything really looks the same millions of years later. It's the same water, the same trees, the same beauty of the land. They fit. Yeah. They fit. The Native Americans fit into the environment. Isn't that interesting? I don't think we fit into the environment.
No. Okay, now, so if you were an outsider politician concerned less with party politics or even electoral success than with advancing the steady state economy, how would you go about it?
Well, certainly renewable energy. And I think, you know, windmills don't bother me. I think they're a good use of natural benefits. And I think solar panels are amazing. You can actually reduce you get yourself into a positive energy bill where you're actually creating more energy than you're using, and it's not hurting you. So I think looking at just a simple thing of being state of the art and using technology to avoid using up resources is a smart, honest thing to do.
But that buys you some time, but then ultimately, you know, you can't expect perpetual GDP growth regardless of, and if you did have it, you'd destroy every other species on the planet. So how about advancing the steady state economy politically? Like, what would be a strategy there? Would you try to win a local race and then work your way up the political ladder?
I do know that people learn to recycle and it becomes a positive habit. And it doesn't happen everywhere, but where it does happen, it has a beneficial advantage in this term of resource reuse. I think it becomes an ethic. You don't throw trash on the street. Nobody throws trash. You know, it's very, the kids, I think, on Friday nights throw beer bottles into the side of the road. And I always wonder what that night was like. But most people don't throw trash out the window of their car. They don't. People learn certain things about that. They pick up the dog dew after the dog's been by. They do learn habits, and people learn habits that they're sort of proud of. And they're almost a statement of good sense and class, if you will, that you know what you're doing as a citizen. Look at this. I've been to places now where nobody smokes. I mean, from a time where I grew up in the 50s where everybody's father smoked, I wanted my father to smoke because I thought it was cool when I thought about it, because everybody seemed to smoke in the movies. You know, I have an occasional cigar, but I got to tell you, it's not something you walk into somebody's house and light up a cigarette. All that's changed because of culture. You know, how many people walk into somebody's house and light up a cigarette? Oh, come on. There's no ashtrays around. I mean, not everywhere, but in big parts of the country, the big cities, certainly, and the burbs. So habits change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't like it when Mike Bloomberg said you can't have a big Coke, but that was his thing. But cigarettes and bars used to be part of the ambience, a smoky bar. I didn't mind it, but the people that worked there did, apparently. The unions did. Yeah. And because they were getting sick, I guess, potentially, because they're working all day in a smoky environment. Look, all I'm telling you, Brian, and you know this, is culture can change habits.
Yes.
So we're still going to face the problem of population and the size of this planet. And
yep.
And the age, what's the average age of somebody on this planet right now? What, 29 or something? I don't know. You got a big challenge there. You know, I wish I'd give as much thought to the Club of Rome report as I did it. I really did at the time. I really thought about it. And maybe I was more revolutionary. I don't know.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that because I know you did pay attention to that. And well, for now, there's a lot of disappointment about the Green Party of the United States, because instead of focusing on, well, green issues, they seem to just take whatever social issue arises and put themselves way off to the left, kind of like boxing themselves into an ever tinier corner. But now, what if the Green Party said, first things first, and focused hard on the environment, basically just riding the fence on all the other issues? How far could they get on the ballots with
I think you've seen the deputies elected in Europe, but they can go very far. And I'm not sure if they're technically involved in the new German government, but they're growing in power in probably the healthiest political country in Europe, Germany. In other words, they know how to hold elections, they're clean about it, and they lead Europe. Mm-hmm. The Green Party in the United States has become a vehicle, as you're suggesting, a vehicle for somebody who wants to run to the left of the Democratic Party, whether it's Ralph Nader, there's Gene Stein. It just says to me, vote left. And they take, you're right, the social issues. You don't think of them as primarily interested in climate, even. as a code word for a general concern about resource depletion and living on this planet. Like the last guy in politics I can think of was Jerry Brown. He talked about spaceship Earth. Remember that? Mm. And the fact we're living on a, basically a contained geography, and we better respect it.
Jerry Brown, you're talking about.
Yeah, Jerry Brown. He was called Moonbeam, Governor Moonbeam, which finally Mike Royko of Chicago, who gave him that nickname, took it back in later years and said that wasn't fair. Because he was talking, you know, you and he, Brian, could talk to Jerry Brown on the same level. Mm-hmm. He's a very big thinker, and he's a speculative thinker, which is rare in politics.
Right.
He thinks beyond the next election.
Yeah.
He always did. And it hurt him.
Yeah, it hurt him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the electoral cycle didn't.
Governor of California and ended up with a balanced budget surplus, I believe. And he knew how to tell people, no, you can't have it. And maybe one of the few Democrats that can actually say, no, you can't have it. We can't have preschool because we don't have the money. He actually said that.
Yeah, kind of like
we don't
Carter.
Have the money. Yeah.
Well, Chris, you're obviously an astute political monitor, so I have sort of a barometric question here. Has the European degrowth movement come onto your radar yet?
No, and I do. I pay attention to the headlines in that, and I notice that whenever there's a decline in population growth, there's a big danger sign that goes up in the headline. Have you noticed?
Yep. Yeah,
that's
sure
the big have. Danger sign. Not that there's too much population growth, but there's a deep population growth, and that becomes a horror sign in Russia and now in China, and I guess in Europe itself, Western Europe, and. I don't know. There's a reckoning that I don't think has reached the voters' table yet, but it's on yours.
Yes. All right, Chris. I want to ask you, which of your occupations have given you the most influence in American politics?
Let me start with the personal feeling about them, because then I'll get to the big picture. I loved writing a column. I did it twice a week. For 15 years with the San Francisco papers, and I loved doing it. I loved being able to go anywhere in the world and write from where I'm at. I loved it. I had complete freedom, and I never got edited except for facts, and I loved it. I loved being on it with President Carter and writing his speeches. There's nothing as much fun if you're pretty young. I was in my early 30s to knowing that you're typing on your Selectric 2 typewriter, something that the President of the United States is going to say possibly on the next stop on the plane. And you're taking off at 45 degrees. Those Air Force planes just go right up in the air. And you're typing at a diagonal angle, and you're writing. I loved it. I loved it. I loved covering political conventions like in New York City when we were on Broadway right out there. And I was with Howard Feynman. And a guy jumped over the fence and tried to knock me over because he was demonstrating against Abu Ghraib, our mistreatment of prisoners over in Iraq. And it's something else. I enjoyed being with Bishop Tutu when he got to vote the first time at age 62. I loved talking to the East Germans and asking them what it was like to have freedom and what freedom meant to them. I loved talking to the Protestants and the Catholics up in Northern Ireland and realizing what that fight was about to some extent. I've been very lucky. I liked Tip O'Neill. You mentioned I was his top guy. I'd be with him every morning when he's leader of the opposition, basically, but also cutting wonderful deals with Ronald Reagan. I mean, they know how to deal together. I loved all that. So I've got a happy time. The Capitol Police time, I actually enjoyed it. It was a patronage job that I took so I could work in the office during the early part of the day. So I'd work in the morning, early afternoon, and then go put on my police uniform and my 38 special pistol at 3 in the afternoon and work till 11. So I was working all around the clock. It was my first job coming back from Africa and the Peace Corps. So I wanted to get a job, and that was the one job that was offered me. So I did like being a Capitol policeman, and I felt a lot for those guys and perhaps to some extent with them when they went through the hell of January 6th this year. And I know their patriotism. And a lot of them were probably guys who this time voted for Trump, or both times, but they were very patriotic about certainly very patriotic about that building and protecting it. So, you know, I've been great. I've been lucky. I'm not great. I'm lucky to be having these jobs.
Well, yeah. And you did great at them. And I think that's why you had so many good ones. You kept doing good at the previous ones. So.